Lisboa, Bruxelles, Berlin, Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, your weekly vessel for random but hopefully interesting chatter about Europe. My name's Dominic Kramer, checking in from Amsterdam, and this week I'm joined by Europe's undisputed queen of puns. Brace yourselves, everyone. It's our favourite Luxembourger in Paris, Nina Lamparsky. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Dominic. I'm back.
Yay. So nice to have you back. Thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm great, Dominic. Thank you. I'm so pleased to be back here. And I bring a little funny story as I was preparing for today's show. I had a real sort of insight into Gen Z relationships. I was sat at my desk. Yes, I was sat at my desk with the balcony doors open. And suddenly on the balcony next to mine, I heard this huge fight between a couple, and they seemed quite young, and she was saying, "This is not what I imagined married life to be like," and it sounded like she was about to leave. I got a bit worried because we're really high up, so I thought perhaps a crime is about to happen. And then after about half an hour of back and forth, I realized that they were arguing over an emoji that he had sent her the night before.
Which emoji?
I don't know. We'll never know. Unfortunately, I couldn't find out. I also felt a little bit pervy sitting there and trying to figure out what they were discussing. But anyway, I thought that was quite interesting, like such a long fight, just over a silly little, I don't know, smiley or cactus or goodness what.
Write in, listeners, with your guesses of which emoji might have created such drama. I mean, I assume it's probably the aubergine emoji, but
I didn't want to say, because last time I was on the show, we talked about pollen cum. I tried to stay clear of sex references.
Okay, well, we're not doing very well, but I guess we should move on quickly before things go downhill.
So how are you?
I'm fine. Nothing as interesting as that has happened to me this week, although I have been doing some backing singing for a Dutch pop star, which was a fun change from my normal opera work. And I have realized that I made a mistake in going into opera, because if you work in pop, people are so nice to you at the venues and they give you so many free snacks. So I think I need to let go of podcasting, let go of opera, move into pop and just, yeah, enjoy my new life of snacks and free drinks.
This obviously forces me to ask you, what is going on in the world of opera? Is anyone mean to you, Dominic?
No. People are not mean to me in the world of opera, but they just expect me to pay for my snacks. I mean, that's the main difference, to be honest.
Oh, that's rude.
I know. Do you get free snacks as a journalist?
No, certainly not where I work. I think in some of the bigger, probably US companies you do, but no, not where I work. I'm pretty sure people like Pavarotti would have gotten free snacks.
That's true, yeah.
And like Placido Domingo and, you know.
That's very true.
Don't know if the younger generations like know who Pavarotti is at this stage, but yeah.
They should do. Go and look him up if you don't know who Pavarotti is. Well, we should probably move on from talking about snacks and discuss what's coming up today. Later on the show, I'm going to be calling up Günter Latsch, an investigative reporter from Der Spiegel, to find out about an investigation he co-authored into the rather shadowy and gruesome world of organ trafficking. His investigation looks specifically into the selling of kidneys in Kenya to German citizens. It's a pretty chilling story, so please keep listening for that. But first, of course, it's time to find out who has had a good week and who has had a bad week in Europe.
Good week. Bad week.
So, Dominic, let me ask you, who's had a good week?
I am giving good week to IKEA, who have been included in a controversial list from the Swedish government naming the top 100 things that make up the cultural canon of Sweden. Now, I'm going to be upfront with you. This is one of those classic good weeks that is actually full of bad news and downsides. And the downsides are actually more interesting to talk about. But you'd already taken bad weeks. So yeah, IKEA probably are pleased to be included on this list. They have a good week. And they've been included on this list along with the likes of some films by Ingmar Bergman, Pippi Longstocking.
Love her.
Or Pippi Langstrump, as they call her in Sweden. And even the concept of paternity leave is on this list. That's also made it onto the cultural canon. Apparently that was introduced in Sweden in 1974.
How progressive.
Very. But there is a very notable exception that's caused a bit of a hoo-ha online. Sweden's most successful musicians are not on the list. There is no ABBA.
What? How has this happened? And more importantly, why?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem kind of farcical not to include ABBA on a list of Swedish cultural goodies. But the panel who have put it together have defended this omission by saying that the list only includes Swedish culture from before 1975. They did this to make sure that the list only contains cultural things that have had a lasting impact on Swedish culture. And they say most of ABBA's contribution to culture came after 1975. But I think that's a rather weak response, especially considering ABBA actually formed in 1972 and had won Eurovision in 1974 with one of their most beloved songs, Waterloo, a song which also was chosen as the best song in Eurovision history at the 50th anniversary of Eurovision in 2005. So yeah, I think this exclusion and the reasoning for it is pretty strange, and I think it's pretty weird to imply in 2025 that ABBA haven't had a lasting impact on culture.
I'm pretty sure that there must be thousands of ABBA fans right now screaming in anger.
I think so.
Like, who are the people making these ridiculous decisions? Who can I send my strongly worded letter of complaint to?
Well, you should be writing to Sweden's government. As I said, this is an official list from the government. Well, maybe actually you could write to the committee itself. And honestly, that committee has not had a totally easy ride since they were commissioned to put this list together a few years ago. One of the five committee members resigned and described the list as very exclusionary. It's also received criticism from many corners of Swedish society, including the likes of the Swedish Academy, the body that hands out the Nobel Prize for Literature, and also the Swedish Writers Association, to name just two of the high-profile institutional critics of the list.
So it's not just ABBA who are feeling pissed off about it?
No, by no means. And yeah, I should mention that the creation of this list, the so-called cultural canon, was included in the coalition agreement of the current minority government. That government is led by the moderates, and it relies on support from the Sweden Democrats, who are a right-wing populist party. The initiative had actually long been a pet project of the Sweden Democrats, and presumably because of that, it was carried forward as part of the coalition deal to secure the support of the politicians from the Sweden Democrats. I don't think it was the only thing that they gave them, but it was one of the sweeteners. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not just ABBA who are feeling offended. This list has been widely criticized for presenting a narrow and conservative view of Swedish culture.
Right.
It entirely excludes Islamic landmarks, despite having a whole religion section and despite approximately 8 to 10% of Sweden's population being Muslim.
Interesting.
The Sami Joik, a traditional form of song in Sami music, is included, but there is criticism that the Sami community weren't involved in putting this list together in the proper way, and the Sami parliament was not consulted at all in the making of this list.
This all sounds quite controversial and not really well thought out, to be honest. No. Like, why even bother making a list like this if it's not representative of modern society, even if they are things that, you know, even if you take 1975 as a sort of starting point, clearly there's some issue here. So I just have to ask, isn't this kind of list always going to be divisive?
Yeah, I mean, it is a good question. Why make this list? The guy who leads the committee, he's a historian called Lars Tregård, claimed in the Dagens Nyheter that the culture canon could be used to help immigrants to integrate. So essentially, he's saying now there's a list where you can find out what is officially Swedish culture. But if that's the case, then why put this rather arbitrary date of only including culture from before 1975? Wouldn't it help immigrants to integrate if they learned about the culture from today as well as the culture from before 1975? I mean, why not include things like the work of Swedish rapper Silvana Imam, who has Syrian-Lithuanian roots and protests racism and homophobia in her work, or the work of the celebrated Swedish novelist and playwright Jonas Hassan Kemiri? Why not give them some Robin or Loreen, or even that lovely Swedish TV series Young Royals?
Oh, that was good.
It was good.
Yeah, I love that.
If you really want to help people integrate, if that is really honestly your goal, then show them that modern Sweden celebrates cultural diversity. In preparing for this Good Week, I read a really good opinion piece in The Guardian from the Stockholm-based cultural critic Gabriel V. Rindborg, in which he outlines why we should be really suspicious when states try to define a national culture, especially when the arts are in the midst of a funding crisis. He also points out that whilst the global right are spending their days criticizing woke culture for policing words, it's actually the right-wing government here who are actually officially deciding which cultural concepts and terms are officially Swedish. I'll link to that article in the show notes because it's really well written, and he both stresses the fact that this cultural listicle will probably just disappear into thin air before we know it, but also that at the same time, it's a triumph for nationalistic ideology. But yeah, if it doesn't disappear into thin air, the committee says that the list isn't fixed. The head of the committee, he calls it a departure hall, not a final destination. So maybe ABBA will make it onto the list one day, although honestly, I don't know if Agneta, Bjorn, Benny and Anna Fried actually care at all. Probably not.
And why would they want to be on that list under these circumstances? They probably wouldn't be in that great company if they don't have, like, because, you know, they were quite revolutionary for their time, in a way, in music terms, and standing for sort of progressive, fun culture, inclusiveness, and this doesn't sound like they'd be in really good company. By the way, if I can just commend you on your Swedish accent, it is excellent.
Oh, thank you. Do you speak Swedish?
Hurdy brody, hurdy gurdy.
I don't know if we can include that.
It's from the Muppets. It's the Swedish Chef.
Oh, yeah.
It isn't just me. It's not me being racist. I'm actually, you know, I hope the Swedish Chef is on that list. Is he on the list? If not, he should be.
I don't think the Swedish Chef is on that list, which is a scandal.
It is a scandal.
Anyway, that was Good Week for IKEA. Although, actually, sorry, I didn't really talk about IKEA at all, but to mention one thing about IKEA, I was surprised to see that the IKEA meatballs didn't make it onto the list on their own. It was just IKEA as a brand.
That's funny. I was going to ask you about this, about whether meatballs and the hot dogs and all of their amazing Christmas cookies and just all the food, basically, that you go there for.
Yeah, so this list is getting more and more problematic the more we look into it.
Yes, I don't like it. I don't know how you say that in Swedish, but no hurdy-gurdy.
Sure, something like that. I guess I probably should have called this segment a good week for the Nationalist Sweden Democrats or a bad week for ABBA, but sure, that was apparently a good week for IKEA. Let's move on. Who's had a bad week?
All right. So, Dominic, do you remember last time when I was on the show and we talked about, well, I talked about US tariffs and the car industry, and I promised myself after that I would choose something very light and easygoing and fun?
I do remember. Yeah. How's that going?
Well, I didn't listen to myself, as usual. So on today's menu, we have AI, music copyright, and EU law.
Oh, it sounds meaty.
Yes, it is meaty. And just a word of warning, it is about to get a teeny tiny bit technical, but because I've had to get my own head around it, I hope that I'll be able to break it down for you guys as well and for the listener. So the Bad Week trophy goes to the world's biggest tech companies, which are accused of stealing millions of songs online to teach their AI chatbots how to make music. That is basically what I'm looking at. So we'll look at how this scandal could strike a sour note with the EU's new AI Act, pun number one. Sorry. I was so pleased when I could.
You know. Thank you.
Basically, so this act, which was passed last year and is now being rolled out, is the first law of its kind trying to actually regulate the Wild West of artificial intelligence. And this obviously applies to the music business as well. So I'm guessing that as an opera singer, this is a topic that concerns you as well, and perhaps regulation could be music to your ears?
I guess it could. I mean, actually, as an opera singer, I'm mainly only working in the live field, so it doesn't affect me personally so much, but yeah, I know it affects all recording artists and also quite a lot of orchestras, actually, who get a lot of their income from making film music, or used to anyway. So yeah, it's a scary topic. Who is it actually in this case that's accusing the tech giants of stealing all that music?
So it's the International Confederation of Music Publishers, or ICMP for short. They're basically the global trade body for music publishers. So these are the people who look after songwriters and their compositions. And the ICMP represents really big names like Universal, Sony and Warner, so the big guns in the music publishing business. The trade body, which is based in Brussels, by the way, so in the heart of EU regulation, says that it has gathered clear evidence of what it calls the largest intellectual property theft in history.
Wow, that's quite a big accusation. What makes them feel justified in saying that?
It claims that its investigation shows that Google, Meta, OpenAI, X, and other tech giants are plundering tens of millions of songs every day to train their AI models.
Just taking a step back for a second, how do you train an AI model?
That's a good question. So basically, you're feeding the AI tool massive amounts of content so that it can spot patterns. So for music, that means you're giving it millions of songs to listen to so that it can learn how melodies, lyrics, and rhythms fit together. And then it generates new songs in the same style. And so the ICMP accuses tech companies of obtaining, or scraping, as we say in techie jargon, these songs illegally without permission of their rightful owners, so the music publishers. And the alleged culprits include, for example, Google's AI tool Gemini, and also Grok, the AI belonging to everyone's favorite unstable genius, Elon Musk. From ABBA and the Beatles to Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran and Beyonce, no artist is safe, according to the ICMP.
We should have just renamed Good Week, Bad Week this week to Bad Week for ABBA.
Terrible week for ABBA.
It would have just been more straightforward. Anyway, this does sound like really bad news for all recording artists.
It is. Pirating songs in this way, if true, if this is actually happening, it could really crush the business model of music publishers. Every time a song is played on the radio, streamed online, or used in a film or advert, there's a license attached to it, and that's how songwriters get paid. Now, if an AI tool swallows up ABBA's entire catalogue and then churns out its own free version of Waterloo, why would anyone bother to pay for the real song if you can have the recycled version? Basically, that's sort of at the heart of this. Mm. And it's not just music. The same thing is happening in other creative industries. So, for example, in journalism, you can now ask Grok, so Elon Musk's AI, to create a picture of Ukrainian soldiers, for example, on the front line. The picture looks real, but it's based on thousands of actual photographs taken by war reporters, reporters who have risked their lives, and the tech companies don't pay them a single euro for doing their job.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds completely outrageous, and surely it can't be legal.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, Dominic. Tech companies tend to argue that they aren't doing anything wrong because they say that they use only publicly available data to train their AI models. And they also insist that tighter limits, restrictions, would stifle AI innovation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually not as straightforward because the lawsuits are piling up already. So one of the biggest involves a US startup called Anthropic. The reason I'm mentioning this is because Anthropic, which runs a chatbot called Claude, it's not like a household name, but it's a pretty big...
I've heard of Claude.
Yes, I'm not surprised. But yeah, so the reason I'm mentioning this is because Anthropic has just agreed to a massive $1.5 billion settlement with US authors for downloading pirated books to train the tool.
Wow.
Yes. And if a judge approves this settlement, it'll be the largest copyright settlement in US history. And the music industry could chase even bigger sums because the licensing of song recordings is much stricter than it is for books.
Right. Okay. So that's the American picture, but Yeah, maybe I forgot to mention it, Nina, but this is a podcast about Europe. So have you looked into how this could play out here in Europe?
Of course I have, because we're lucky to live basically on a continent where restrictions are already in place to help protect us a little bit from what big tech firms are doing. And this is where I'm going to get a little bit technical, okay? And
go for
it. This does bring back haunting memories of the US tariffs, but I'm going to try and be simple on this. So within the European context, basically, the tech giants lean on what is called text and data mining rules. So EU law lets you use creative content to train your AI unless the rights holder has activated an opt-out option that tells the software it's not allowed to copy the song. So you can think of this as a digital do not enter sign. Mm-hmm. Now, the EU's Shiny New AI Act takes this a step further. From now on, tech companies face two big obligations. First, they need a clear copyright policy that respects those opt-outs. And second, they have to publish a detailed summary of what went into training their AI. There's actually a standard template from Brussels, like by Brussels, and that they have to fill out. So they can't just provide a document from in-house. They have to actually, there's, as usual.
Classic Brussels.
There's a form for this. Yeah. You know? And so basically, importantly, those rules count in Europe, no matter where in the world the model was trained, no matter where it's from. So as soon as you are operating on EU soil, you have to respect these rules.
So the law applies to AI companies, no matter where they're based. But given that this is an EU law, does it mean European artists are better protected than musicians from somewhere else, like in the US, for example?
Well, in theory, yes. Except that, as usual, there's a snag. Mm. You knew that was coming. It wasn't going to be easy, was it?
No.
So the AI Act has what some European lawmakers and creative lobby groups are referring to as a devastating loophole. Because the default mode for text and data mining is opt out, not opt in at the moment.
Could you spell that out for idiots like me? What does that mean?
Trust me, I know how you feel because I sat there just a few days ago. I felt the same. So basically, to put it in plain English, AI companies can use your work by default unless you put up a digital red flag to say, no, bugger off. Now, critics say that the issue with that is that it flips the burden the wrong way around. It means that artists basically have to defend themselves instead of companies asking permission first. And that's why musicians fear that Google and other tech firms may argue that what they're doing is legal. They'll say, well, there's no red flag. There was no sign. So we're entitled to use it. It's fair usage, basically.
Oh, that's very shady. This sounds like it's really a serious problem for European recording musicians. Well, and for recording musicians all over the world. There must be a lot of sleepless nights at the moment.
Yes, and I'm sure that this latest scandal, allegedly uncovered by the ICMP, is on their radar, especially while Brussels is still ironing out the fine print of the AI Act. So as I mentioned before, even though the law was passed last year, legislators are still working out the fine print and how it's going to work in practice. And that's where changes or delays can creep in. And there are genuine fears that the toughest rules linked to transparency and copyright could get watered down, either under pressure from lobbyists or, of course, to keep big tech companies sweet so they keep investing here. Mm-hmm. And just a few weeks ago, more than 30 European artists released a video campaign called Stay True to the Act. And the message was very clear. Keep AI transparent. Let creators know if their work has been used to train AI and protect their right to say no.
And so the ICMP has done all this research. What can they actually do with their findings?
So individual members of the ICMP, so the music publishers, can sue on their own. Some, like Universal, have already taken tech companies to court in separate cases, in other cases. But the ICMP as a trade body could file a formal complaint with EU regulators. If they can prove that companies have ignored opt-outs, now you know what it means, mm-hmm. That's a breach of the Act. And if a company cannot provide a training data summary, that's another breach. And the AI Act gives Brussels real teeth. Regulators can investigate and hand out fines if tech companies breach the law. You're looking at up to 35 million euros or importantly, 7% of a company's worldwide turnover, whichever is higher.
Whoa, 7% of 7%. Google's turnover is a lot of money.
That could mean billions.
Wow, so it sounds like we're headed for a rather big showdown between music publishers and the tech giants. Who would you predict is going to win this battle?
Oh, good question. And I wish I had the answer, but I'm unable to provide specifics on this. However, I mean, if you look at what happened, for example, with Spotify and Apple when they first came onto the scene, I mean, tech giants could potentially strike blanket licensing deals with publishers, just like Spotify and Apple did with record labels in the early days of streaming. That's one way, like a truce. However, we could also end up with test cases in your courts, which will have to draw the line on where data mining stops and copyright begins. So right now it's quite murky still. I think it's going to be a really interesting topic to follow in the coming months. But in any case, I think it's definitely time for tech to face the music.
Oh, good pun to end it with.
Thank you.
Now comes the part of the show where we need to be quite honest with you. We can only keep making this podcast if enough of you decide to support us financially. We don't love asking, but it is essential as it's the only path to making this show sustainable. Right now, we're very lucky to be part of Euronet Plus, a fantastic European radio collaboration that gives us a bit of temporary stability and the chance to work with amazing radio makers across the continent. But this support is time limited, and when it ends, we absolutely have to be standing on our own feet. If we haven't built up enough listener support by then this podcast won't be able to continue. So if you value what we do, please don't wait. Join our membership program at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Even a small monthly contribution makes a huge difference. And if donating isn't possible right now, you can still help by spreading the word. Tell your friends, share the show on Instagram, help us grow our community. This week, we have a few new supporters to thank. They are Tom, Alexander, Petra, Anya, Anna, and also thank you to Marcella and Olivia for increasing their donations. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Time for today's interview. And this is the segment of the show this week that is made in collaboration with our radio partners at Euronet Plus. Now, at any one time, there are many thousands of people in Europe waiting for kidney transplants. For example, in Germany, according to data from Eurotransplant at the year end of 2024, there were over 6,000 people waiting for a kidney to become available. And yeah, you might be shocked to hear that in Germany, the average time on the waiting list for a kidney is 6 to 10 years.
My God, presumably they have to be on dialysis for all that time while they're waiting.
Probably not everyone, because some people may be getting the kidney transplant preemptively. But yes, a lot of people on this waiting list for a kidney will be receiving regular dialysis treatments during these many years of waiting. And yeah, that can take a really big toll on you. Now, because of this huge wait, some Germans have been heading to Kenya to illegally buy a new kidney in order to significantly shorten their waiting time. A group of investigative journalists from Der Spiegel, ZDF and Deutsche Welle earlier this year decided to look into these kidney transplants in Kenya. And what they discovered is a seemingly criminal kidney trade in which Kenyans and people from Caucasus nations such as Azerbaijan were being offered a few thousand euros in exchange for one of their kidneys, which would then be sold on at a huge markup to people in need of kidneys from Germany, Israel, Somalia, and elsewhere. It's a really extraordinary piece of reporting that I think not only shines a light on the shadowy and extremely medically risky industry of organ trafficking, but also brings up questions about why it is that some European citizens have to wait so long for their organ transplants, and why there are such big differences on the waiting list times depending on which European country you live in. So to find out a bit more about that, I was very happy to have the chance to chat with one of the journalists behind this investigation. Here's my conversation with Günter Latsch from Der Spiegel. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Günter, on The Europeans. We're really excited to talk about your investigation. You've reported on Chinese prisons, eco-friendly undertakers, Cristiano Ronaldo's finances, the link between the peace movement and the extreme right, just to name a few topics. How did you come to report on the kidney trade?
Well, that was the merit of my colleague Heiner Hoffmann, who was based in Nairobi, Kenya. There has been some reporting about organ trafficking in Western Kenya, and he went to Eldoret and to Oyugis, which is a small village where more than 100 young men have given their kidneys for small sums of money, about 2,000 euros or dollars. And when he made his reporting, it was last year in spring, we got contacted by a guy who was working for the ICG. This is the Declaration of Istanbul Custodian Group. I think it was fixed in 2008 by nephrologists and by the International Transplant Society to prevent organ trafficking and to fight it. And they had information about people who went to Kenya, and they had even the name of the organization, MedLead. That was the starting point for us.
And this organization, MedLead, it's an organization that like acquires these kidneys and sells them. They've been in operation for over 3 years. And in some ways, it's kind of been an open secret. And in some ways, it's quite surprising that this hasn't become an international scandal much sooner. Why do you think it's taken so long to come out?
I think, first of all, it was seemingly public when you have the first hint. You could see the videos, the people who got their kidneys in Kenya made for the MedLead company. But if you see, it was a small audience, 40 up to 50 people who watched these videos. You could see it on YouTube and on Instagram. And we were really astonished when we saw how publicly all this was advertised when we first had the information where to look at. It's shockingly open. You know, it was a German website. It was registered in Germany, a German company, and they were openly advertising, get a new kidney in 6 weeks, within 6 weeks, wow. Which is legally not feasible, never and nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I found most striking about your reporting was that at the center of your story in Der Spiegel, there's this woman called Sabina Fischer-Kugler, who received a kidney from someone in the Caucasus and flew to Kenya. Why do you think she was so willing to be so open about it in your piece? I mean, she even had her photos there.
Well, that was big surprise for us too, because what we did when we saw the videos, we went through the internet with a face recognition program, and you can find all these people because they say their first names, they have face to camera, they're not hidden. And if you have a face recognition program, you get to their Facebook or whatever accounts and you can find them quite easily. And we found about 6 or 8 people in Germany and we contacted them all. Most of them were willing to talk in the beginning and even agreed to be interviewed. But a few days later, seemingly after talking to a lawyer, they said no, or even went at us with, we sue you if you publish my name, all that. And Sabine Fischer-Kugler was the only one who said yes, I think, because she was already a kind of public figure in Germany, because she had her first kidney transplant, legal kidney transplant, when she was 25. And she advertised all the time in local newspapers and even in nationwide that people should agree to give their kidneys after death, to have a organ donor card and all that. So she was for years advocating new rules on donating. And that's what perhaps convinced her to talk to us, because she was so convinced that the system in Germany and the system in a lot of other countries is so bad for people who need transplant organs that she should advertise for even more unorthodox ways.
Mm-hmm. You think she was at peace with her decision?
Oh, she still is. She still is. She said, and this was a shocking moment in the interview, where she said, well, listen, after all, at least I have a new kidney.
Yeah, so she paid around something like 200,000 euros. That's an extraordinary markup, considering that the person who is giving their kidney is only getting a few thousand euros. What do we know about these people that provide their kidneys? And what does their life look like after they've sold an organ to Medlead?
Well, there's no care at all. That's what we know. We talked to one or two of them. If they have problems, health problems, they won't be accepted to come back and get their problems solved. So they're spit out by the system, you know. They get their money and then the whole thing is over. And it's even dangerous for people who paid a lot of money, like the story of an Israeli woman shows that we reported in our article, because she got a kidney which never would have been transplanted if medically serious people were responsible for the transplantation, because the tissue comparison stuff, the blood comparison stuff in the laboratory said, don't transplant. No, there's no match, you know. And that was even marked on the papers we got. And they transplanted it nevertheless, just because they got the money. And the kidney was, I think it was taken out 2 or 4 weeks later.
Wow.
And she sold a house to buy this kidney. Now she's on dialysis again and then lives in a small flat because she can't afford more. And she got paid all their money to these crooks who treated her and something.
And how did the company Medlead respond to the allegations in your investigation?
Well, to my astonishment, they answered a list of questions. I sent them 40 questions, very detailed about our findings. And they said, well, listen, this is all legal. You got your information in illegal ways. They accused us in bribing medical personnel in Kenya. They threatened to sue us in court. But this was all the normal ballyhoo, you know.
I find myself feeling a bit conflicted when reading your article, because, of course, I feel, I notice myself judging the decision of someone like Sabina, who's decided to pay all this money to get a kidney that someone's been paid for. But on the other hand, she's in a desperate situation with kidney failure where she needs to find a kidney. And do you have any sense of what a country like Germany could be doing better to make sure that someone like Sabina has more options? Because she really didn't have options in her own country, in her home country, to do this in a safer way, did she?
Well, not really, because it's a waiting list which says it's 8 years up to 10 if you get legally a kidney from a donor who's dead, you know?
Yeah, so she'd have to be on dialysis.
Yeah, or you have a relative who's willing to give you his or hers. That's also a possibility. But the biggest problem is the German law system, because we have just the opt-in solution, which means you have explicitly to declare your will to be an organ donor. In countries like Spain, it's totally different. Everybody who doesn't opt out is a donor if he dies in a car accident or whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's legal and you have not these problems. I think the waiting list in Spain is half a year for a kidney, which, fun fact, leads to the situation that a lot of EU citizens went to Spain, live there, pay Spanish health system costs, and get on the Spanish donor list. And as far as I know, the Spanish are already trying to change their legal conditions as far as transplant services are concerned, because they have a kind of medical tourism that. So this is the legal way. You can do medical tourism or organ trafficking.
What has the response been like to your story, both in Germany and in Kenya?
In Kenya, it was overwhelming. We never would have thought that. And the Kenyan newspapers, Kenyan media in general, immediately took over the story and accused their government. And the new government said, oh, well, listen, what a surprise. We didn't know that. They sure knew it. And they said, well, we take action now. There's a new commission who is investigating the whole thing again. Ranjan Mishna, the guy who is the owner of the Eldoret Medihil clinic where the transplantation took place, was a member of parliament in Kenya, and he was the head of the BioX commission appointed by President Ruto. This is all on hold now, and there's an investigation ongoing. This was overwhelming. In Germany, it was quiet. We were astonished because a few papers told the story, but there was no discussion about the legal conditions and the whole situations in Germany, which is astonishing because in Germany, we learned that there are a lot of people, a lot more people who have transplants abroad than we thought before. It's quite easy to detect because everybody who's get a transplant organ abroad has to go home for medical care. And he shows up in dialysis centers or he shows up in a nephrologist clinic. And if they ask, where did you get your kidney? Well, the answer is, well, I didn't get it here, not in Germany. And so there's the suspicion is there that this is a not legally acquired organ. And they are normally obliged to report this. But as far as I know, only a few of doctors and clinics did this in the last year.
I recorded that interview with Gunther earlier in the summer, and since then, the Kenyan task force, who are investigating potential organ trafficking, has recommended the prosecution of the founder and chairman of the Mediheal hospital where these kidney transplants allegedly took place. So some things are changing in Kenya since this reporting. I'll share a link in the show notes to the original piece in Der Spiegel and also to a recent news report about that recommendation for prosecution from the Kenyan newspaper, The Standard. It's time to step into the Inspiration Station, the part of the show in which we share some European culture that we've enjoyed lately. Nina, tell me, what have you been enjoying?
I'd like to give a shout out to my little sister who recommended an excellent book called Love in Five Acts by a German author named Daniela Kreen. And basically, she's part of this new generation of German women writers who bring us very strong female characters, but who are neither superheroes nor cautionary tales. They're just ordinary women trying to navigate very messy life. Yes, it's really great because it's basically this particular book was about five women whose lives keep brushing up against each other in East Germany after the fall of the wall. So suddenly you have to imagine suddenly there's freedom, but also infinite new choices. And this can, I guess, feel more like a weight than liberation.
Oh, yeah.
And the themes are pretty blunt. So I think for people who are feeling a bit fragile, be careful because it does discuss some pretty sad things like losing a child. There are stories about abortion, cheating. I make it sound quite sad, upsetting. But really, it's great because it kind of just shows you how, you know, in all of these dark things that can happen, there are like these moments of strength and sort of just how you can kind of navigate this. We're flawed and it's okay to be flawed, basically. You know, you can be an asshole, but you can be a nice asshole. And sometimes, you know, even nice people will do bad things. And so I guess that's kind of what I really enjoyed. And then the backdrop of East Germany after the war fall is quite interesting because there's also this clash between people who are still in love with the old regime and how it used to be so much better in the past and kind of a conservative worldview, and then the newer sort of people who look towards the future and who are embracing this new world. And yeah, and what I really liked was that the book doesn't really spin these struggles into melodrama. It just lets them sit there, messy and kind of, you know, just like real life is, I guess. I highly recommend it.
Sounds great. What's it called again?
It's called Love in Five Acts by Daniela Kreen. And I looked it up and it's definitely, you can get it in English. I read it in German, but it does exist in English.
Sounds great. I'll put it on my book list.
And what about you, Dominic? What is your inspiration station? What got your creative juices flowing this week?
Well, seeing as we've been talking about musicians in Good Week, Bad Week, I wanted to talk about an album that I've been really enjoying over the summer that was at least partly recorded in Sweden. Definitely didn't make it onto the cultural canon list.
I detect a theme though.
But yeah, Sweden, I mean, it's somehow this place where so much of the best pop music is made. I really want to do an interview on this topic one day. Like, what is it they're putting in the water over there? Anyway, the album I wanted to mention is Addison Rae's debut album titled originally Addison. Do you know who she is?
No, I don't.
She's a former TikTok star, and this album contains a few absolutely perfect trashy pop songs, including Headphones On and my favorite, the viral hit Diet Pepsi, a song that contains perhaps the most vulgar modulation of this millennium. And now, I should be honest, Addison is from the US, so maybe I'm kind of breaking the rules with this recommendation.
Ooh.
But the reason I wanted to mention it is not only that it was partly recorded in Stockholm, but because the album is produced and co-written by two amazing European producers, two female European producers, in fact.
This is amazing.
Something that is still depressingly rare in the pop industry. According to studies, it seems like only about 5 or 6% of producers working in the industry are women. So the fact that this album, which has been critically acclaimed, is produced by two European women made me very happy. They are Luca Closer, who grew up between Austria and Luxembourg, Nina.
No, yes. You're joking. Is that why you chose her? Admit it. The real reason was just to come back. That's crazy. Maybe I know her. Maybe we're related.
Probably, right? I mean, how many people live there?
Well, now that I'm gone, four.
Yeah. And she made it with the Stockholm-born Elvira Anderfjärd, a protege of Swedish hitmaker Max Martin, the guy who wrote Hit Me Baby One More Time and all those other hits. Mm. Anyway, this album won't be to everyone's taste, I'll be honest. But if you, like me, have been into it, then I recommend watching a YouTube video from Variety in which Addison, Luca and Elvira break down how they wrote Headphones On. It's called Headphones On Behind the Song. I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
I can't wait to listen to it. I'm intrigued.
Time for a quick happy ending to round off the show and leave you all, hopefully, in a good mood. And this week I'm taking you to Denmark, where archaeologists have uncovered evidence of an 8,500-year-old underwater city in the Bay of Aarhus.
I'm just flabbergasted. What? How was it hidden so long, and what's left of it?
I guess it was hidden because it was underwater. The city is being called by some Stone Age Atlantis, and the archaeologists say that some of the objects they are finding are preserved as if they were in a time capsule because they were under the sea without oxygen.
That's amazing. Do we know how deep it is?
It's between 0.6 and 8 meters deep.
Wow.
But honestly, when I say so well preserved, I think the objects are so well preserved, but it's not like there's like a whole city under there.
No, but I think for archaeologists, obviously the fact that you can find objects that you can trace back to that time, that's very exciting.
Yeah, well, the people working on the project seem to be very excited about their findings so far, and they're hoping that the underwater dig will help them better understand how people lived in the Mesolithic era. There's also an idea that perhaps we might get some tips on how people in the past moved away from places that were flooded after the last ice age ended.
Oh, interesting.
So the lost city is now underwater because of all the ice caps that melted back then. And there's going to be a lot of that happening in the coming centuries. So tips and tricks from the Mesolithic era might be much needed.
I thought you said this was a happy ending.
Yeah, sorry. Okay.
I feel like you're misleading us in this show, this episode. Like, there's a lot of misleading going on.
It's what I do with good and bad and happy. Yeah, I'm terrible at it. Anyway, I will leave you with a fun factoid that they are retrieving a lot of the objects using a kind of underwater vacuum. And I got a bit stuck in a rabbit hole just watching YouTube videos of this vacuum sucking up objects from the seabed.
Are you sharing a link?
I can share a link in the show notes, yes.
I think listeners will want to see that vacuum. I do, anyway.
I will do that. Well, thank you, Nina, so much for joining me today. It was really lovely having you here again. Will you come back and join me again sometime soon?
I will, but definitely next time I'm not talking about tariffs or EU acts or legislators, or I'm going to choose something really lighthearted. Maybe I'll find some underwater city in a lake in Luxembourg. tell you about.
Well, you can choose whatever you want next time, and it's your own responsibility to make sure you don't choose something that's too mammoth.
Thank you, you're right. And thank you for having me. It was just lovely to be here once again with you and the listeners.
The pleasure was all mine. This week's episode was produced by Katz Laszlo, Morgan Childs, and Wojciech Oleksiak. We'll be back next week when we'll be wondering what would happen if we dreamed wildly about what Europe could be. Intrigued?
Very.
Hey door.
Hey door.